Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, April 21st, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio, which is north of New York City. Well, Taylor, it's like we're in Michael Jordan appreciation time, and even in General Manager Week on the podcast, we had that when we talked with Sandy Alderson, the longtime executive for the Athletics, the Padres, and the Mets. He told us a story about Jordan that I had never heard before about how he got an opportunity to play in the big leagues. Now, I sent it to our news desk yesterday, and they were like, yeah, you know, there was a small story on it when he first said it out loud many years ago. But I had never heard this story before, Taylor.
No, and he says that he doesn't think he's ever told it out loud. I guess he had at least one other time, but it escaped him really at the moment. And it's almost like Sandy has been in on all these email chains and these meetings to promote the heck out of The Last Dance. He was totally on point. Company man.
Yeah, I asked him the question that sort of kicked it off was, you know, what was the biggest deal that you attempted that didn't come to fruition? And when Michael Jordan came up in the answer, that was a big surprise. So we'll be talking with Sandy Alderson today. You'll hear a lot of that interview. He had a lot of insight from his time in front offices. With the revenue spigot turned off, Major League Baseball and teams and players, like a lot of employers, employees, are involved in some increasingly difficult money situations. This story broke yesterday. A pair of fans from New York are suing Major League Baseball, each individual club, and ticket resellers over tickets purchased for MLB games that haven't been played due to the coronavirus pandemic. The complaint filed Monday in California seeking class action certification to add more plaintiffs who are, quote-unquote, similarly situated. According to Jeff Passan, 18 clubs have told baseball operations employees that they will be paid through May, with some or all of the teams potentially deciding to pay staff longer. The Padres told employees that they would be paid through the end of the scheduled season, though a number will take pay cuts that one employee deemed very reasonable. Some, according to Jeff's report, some high-revenue teams, including the Yankees, Dodgers, Mets, and Nationals, have not yet given employee assurances of payment through May. Derek Jeter heads the Marlins will forego his $5 million salary indefinitely. And we've been talking about baseball resuming in South Korea. Well, that is official now. The South Korean Baseball League is set to open their regular season on May 5th. Before we get to Tim Kirchin's Daily Baseball Fix and to Sandy Alderson's stories about Ricky Henderson and the book Moneyball, I just want to let you know ESPN Podcast has you covered with plenty of NFL draft coverage. You can hear our draft gurus, Todd McShay and Mel Kiper Jr., on the latest episode of First Draft and the two most recent episodes of the College Football Podcast. Find them wherever you get your podcasts. Here's Tim Kirchin's Baseball Fix about Brady Anderson.
On this date in 1996, Brady Anderson set a major league record by hitting a leadoff home run for the fourth consecutive game. Before that game, I talked to him at the bat rack at Oriole Park, and he jokingly looked at me and he said, "The cork bats are in the bag over there." And that's why I love covering Brady Anderson. There was no telling what he might say and do. In 1989, I told him, "You are leading all leadoff men in slugging percentage," and he responded, "I floss more than any leadoff man." And in 1992, while he's in the MVP race in the American League, Brady is at an outdoor cafe in Baltimore after a game. A young guy comes up to him and says, "I was a sprint champion in high school, and I could blow your doors off anytime I want." So Brady Anderson got up, went out into the parking lot, took off his shirt, raced this guy three times, and crushed him every time. He was a very good player for a long time, but one season he was hitting 178 in May. So after another 0-for-4, he and teammate Rene Gonzalez went out, was in a rainstorm, and they were driving way too fast. And Brady looked at his buddy and said, "Gonz, if I wasn't hitting 178, I'd ask you to slow down."
Sandy Alderson has been the general manager of the Oakland Athletics, the chief executive officer for the San Diego Padres, and the general manager for the New York Mets, and is currently a senior advisor for the Oakland Athletics. Sandy, how are you doing?
Doing very well, thanks. In isolation with as are most people these days, but we're getting through it.
Well, I appreciate you joining us and helping us to distract at a time when baseball fans are just starved for stories. And, you know, you were one of the first people I thought of that I wanted to talk to, because I've never talked to you about some of these personalities and things that you've experienced. Given the range of people that you run across in your career, no doubt you have stories on Ricky Henderson, who's one of the seems to be one of those guys that everybody's got a story about. I'm curious about yours.
Well, quite a few years ago, I had my 25th college reunion and was asked at the time about my hobbies. And the only one I came up with was my hobby was trading Ricky Henderson. So that happened on more than one occasion. Of course, we traded him, we got him back, traded him again, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, Ricky, probably the best player I ever witnessed playing firsthand, just a great player, and a lot of probably apocryphal stories about him and his third person references and you know, some of the yogiisms that he came up with. But you know, one of the things that I remember, this is about Ricky, but encompasses something larger than that. We were in the process of trying to trade Ricky in 1984 for reasons which I can't quite remember. But in any event, we ended up trading the New York Yankees. And the two things that were interesting about that transaction, number one, Ricky had two agents at the time, which made it a little bit difficult to negotiate with another team, because the Yankees in particular wanted him to have a multi-year obligation once they made the trade. So there was a contract negotiation going on. And then, of course, we had to just figure out what players we wanted in return. And in those days, I was relatively new, very new to the business, to the job. Wasn't quite sure about our scouting operations. And as it turns out, there was a baseball publication that was only about a year old at that time, which still exists today, very prominent, very influential, Baseball America. Anyway, they print the, you know, top 10 this, top 10 that, and they had just printed the Yankees top 10 prospect list. So I asked the Yankees for their top 5 prospects out of Baseball America. That was our ask. And I'd have to go back and look, but I think we got all 5 of them. Are pretty close, and 4 of the 5 players made real contributions to the A's. So Jay Howell was in that group, Jose Rio, Stan Javier, Eric Plunk, who was a relief pitcher, who ended up going back to the Yankees when we reacquired Ricky, and then another guy named Tim Bursis, who really did not make it. But in any event, it was one of those, you know, it was in the early years of these publications. And, you know, my attitude was that probably a third party analysis was just as good as our own. And so that's the route we took.
Sandy, and that's one of those stories that's hard to imagine in this day and age, as you know. But back then, that was kind of, it felt like that a lot of teams worked that way, right? Where it felt like that if you made a list of some kind, that was a good reference point for teams.
Well, at the time, there was a lot of mistrust of publications like Baseball America, because a lot of, you know, insiders felt that, you know, clubs would be feeding the publication the names they wanted on the list, and that there wasn't any real independent evaluation. But I looked at it differently and thought that it was probably as objective as anything I was going to find. And perhaps based on a broader set of information than anything I had available otherwise. So anyway, it was a young publication at the time, but, you know, I felt it had value. I'm not sure the old timers at that time did feel there was value in it, but obviously the way in which independent judgment and data is looked at today is very different.
Now, you mentioned there are a lot of stories about Ricky, and some of them are apocryphal to the degree that when he had made an appearance on Mike and Mike on ESPN, I got in touch with the producers. I'm like, here's 10 stories. Just asked him which of these are true. And one of the stories that they asked him about was the story about framing a check that he got, a bonus check. And he said on air, yeah, that one was true. And I wanted to hear your perspective on that story from how you heard about that.
Well, I don't remember the story about framing the check, but I do remember a story about him not cashing a check.
Right.
And our CFO at the time asked, you know, us to inquire because our books weren't balancing. There was a check outstanding and it hadn't been cashed. And so I had somebody reach out to Ricky, and Ricky's response was, I'm not going to cash it until the interest rates go up. I guess, you know, waiting for them to go up was better than zero. So, anyway, that check, I don't think made it on the wall. I think it made it in the top drawer of his credenza. But anyway, yeah, there were stories like that about Ricky. I have to tell you, you know, Ricky had this kind of flamboyant, look at me kind of personality when he was playing, which was, you know, depending on your perspective, was either something you really enjoyed, as I think we did the second time around at least, or something you hated, you know, typically an opponent that just, you know, would grind their teeth every time Ricky came out and did this or did that. But as Ricky got older and really after he retired, he's one of the nicest and nicest gentlemen, I think, that I know in the game. He's just really a completely different person. And I remember, you know, the Haas family owned the team back in the day, and Walter Haas passed away, and of course, and Ricky was there. It was kind of a command performance in a way. But then later on, Walter's wife passed away, and Ricky showed up. It was, you know, and he wasn't in the Bay Area. It's not like he was a few blocks away. It was, and he wasn't, you know, it wasn't an expectation. It was just really, I thought, an extraordinarily generous act on his part. He was there, and I think that's how he is. There's a lot more sentimentality and emotion there than one would have guessed, I think, based on his playing career.
Sandy, the two players that I covered who I thought had the purest confidence were Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera. That Derek assumed every game that he played, he would find a way to win it in the end. And Rivera absolutely believed that he was going to execute in every save opportunity. And from afar, and I don't really know Ricky the way that you know him, I'm guessing he might be in that category. And I want to ask you about that. And also, when his Hall of Fame vote was announced, there were 539 voters and 511 voted for him. And it blew my mind. Like, how would it be that you wouldn't vote for Ricky Henderson for the Hall of Fame? And maybe I care about that too much. I was curious if you had any thoughts on that when that was announced.
You know, to me, there were probably 25 or 30 writers who were of the old school, didn't like the antics, didn't like the way in which he carried himself and on the field. And, you know, in that sense, decided for some reason he wasn't worthy of their first round ballot. I mean, that's the only thing that I can think of. You know, Ricky was a product of his environment. He came out of Oakland and had the that kind of attitude toward conventional wisdom, if you will. You know, in his case, it was a world he came out of. It was a world he knew. It was a world he appreciated and emulated. And there wasn't anybody that was going to deter him from that. And, you know, I applaud him for the way he sort of carried himself without regard to what other people thought about him. And, of course, part of his attitude on the field was a function of his talent. I mean, he did have supreme confidence. you know, Ricky was one of these guys that really could do it all, knew he could do it all, and, you know, was able to do it on a pretty regular basis. You talk about power, base stealing, even defense in left field. He was the total package. He knew it. He had a reputation for, having a certain flair, and that didn't change whether he was playing in Oakland or New York or Toronto. I think it's the reason we were able to get him back from New York, because I think he kind of pissed people off in New York, fans and maybe the organization, when his production went down a little bit there. Their tolerance for some of the stuff he did also went down. But in that sense, we were fortunate that we were able to get him back. And by that time, we were well aware of the antics and happy to have him back, notwithstanding.
On the eve of the 87 season, speaking of Hall of Famers, you dealt for Dennis Eckersley, and there's a decision made to switch him from a starting pitcher, which he'd been pretty much his entire career up to that point, into relief pitcher. When did you feel like, wow, we might have something?
Well, you know, that deal, we acquired Dennis in spring training that year. And I think that, you know, a couple of things came to bear. One was that, you know, he had had some alcohol issues during his previous years in the big leagues. And that year, I think, had decided, okay, that's enough. And I think we were aware of that before we acquired him. But the second thing was, he wasn't pitching at the time, because I think he had swung a bat in spring training and pulled an intercostal or something and just wasn't pitching. So we were looking for an extra starter, really. And Ron Schuler and I kind of pushed the deal through. Honestly, I don't recall Tony even being that excited about acquiring him, frankly, Tony La Russa. So we were able to get him and brought him in and thought he would be, you know, an extra starter for us. And Tony, I don't know whether it was because, and now this is my perspective, okay, so you could ask Tony, he may have a different perspective, but I don't know whether it was because, you know, Tony wasn't really all that happy that we'd made the acquisition or what, but he wouldn't start him. In fact, he pitched him in kind of middle relief for quite a while. And then Jay Howell, I think, got hurt at some point, who was our closer at the time, and Dennis jumped in and, you know, became a Hall of Famer as a result. But Tony and Dave Duncan were the guys that moved into the pen. I can remember saying, hey, come on, let's start him. You know, what are we waiting for? And, you know, Tony can be pretty stubborn. And so rather than pushing him to the front end of the game, he decided to push him to the back end of the game. And, you know, proved to be Hall of Fame worthy.
What was the biggest deal that you nearly made that we never found out about in the media? Something that you thought, wow, if we could get this done, that would be huge. But in the end, it didn't come to fruition.
Well, the deal that comes to mind, that wouldn't have been, you know, huge in a probably a baseball sense, but the story is timely because of the ESPN documentary that started last night on Michael Jordan and his last championship year with the Chicago Bulls. You recall when Jordan stopped playing basketball and decided to try baseball and was ultimately went down to the Birmingham Barons, Chicago White Sox affiliate. When I heard that was happening or about to happen, I called his agent right away and said, hey, look, I understand he may be going to Double A. I said, look, I don't even know who the 25th man is on our team, our major league team right now. I will sign him and put him on the major league roster. He'll be part of our 25-man team tomorrow.
You're kidding.
No. And you know, the agent hemmed and hawed, and I don't know whether he said, I'll get back to you, or let me think about it, or what have you, but it never came to fruition. But I was totally serious, and I was so serious that I know that this ended up getting some, creating some discussion, because I ended up getting either a phone call or a message from the White Sox saying, hey, what's going on here? This guy, you know, this guy is going to be part of the White Sox organization. Now, you know, there's a relationship between the White Sox and the Bulls, but in any event, somebody accused me of tampering and this and that. So wait a minute, the guy's a basketball player. But anyway, that's one that got away. It would have been fun, but didn't come to fruition.
Sandy, what would
Wouldn't
you
have
done
won
with
the World
Series? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Not sure what we would have done with him, but I'm sure he would have played. We were going nowhere at that time. I don't know what year that was. 94,
93, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it was 93,
so,
yep.
It wasn't about, oh, we got a spot for him. We got, you know, he's got a particular skill. That wasn't the idea. The idea was, hey, we got Michael Jordan on the team. And who knows what kind of interest that would have generated.
Wow. I never heard that story before.
Yeah, no, that one, that happened.
Wow. Well, that's a great story. I want to ask you, you were witness to some of the more memorable moments in baseball history. One, obviously, one against you, the Kirk Gibson home run in 1988. What do you remember about that?
Oh, well, keep in mind that I'm biased, but, you know, the thing about that sequence that bugged me the most was, well, there were two or three things that bugged me about it, but so I was sitting right behind our dugout, like the first or second row with one of the owners, Wally Haas, when he hit it out. And my son was sitting on my lap, I think, and it was one of those, you know, as Jack Buck described it, I don't believe what I just saw, moments. But I think what bugged me the most about it was the fact that Eck walked Mike Davis just before he pitching to Kirk Davis. Now, Mike Davis had played for the A's the year before. And, you know, we had let him go. He ended up having a really lousy year for the Dodgers, but made up for it with one at bat. He walked. I don't know whether it was a 3-2 pitch or not, but he walked. And, you know, Dennis Eckersley never walked anybody. If you go back and look at that season, I don't know if he walked 10 guys in the whole year, but he walked him. And now, again, I'm biased. And so I was, you know, one, incensed that it was Mike Davis, and two, incensed that it was a National League umpire behind the plate. You know, in those days, there were National League and American League umpires, and during the World Series in an American League park, the American League umpires were behind the plate and vice versa. And the National League umpire was Doug Harvey, you know, Mr. Hall of Fame umpire. And, now, I haven't gone back and looked at all the tapes and this and that, but, you know, I always felt in my emotion, my emotional state that Eck got squeezed. And, you know, my experience subsequently with the Major League office was there were clear distinctions between the National League and the American League. And actually, there was real animosity between the two staffs, and who knows how that factored in. But the second thing was, you know, Eckersley, so Gibson, I guess, hit an off-speed 3-2 pitch, and the story was that the Dodger scouts knew that on a 3-2 pitch, Eckersley always threw a off-speed breaking ball. And that had been in the scouting report and yada, yada, yada. And most of us with the A's thought that was total BS because, number one, he seldom got to a 3-2 count during the course of the season. He just had that pinpoint accuracy. And even at a 3-2 count, none of us could really recall specifically that he, you know, threw these off-speed breaking balls. So anyway, that whole scenario was just, I think the first game of the World Series is incredibly important, any World Series. And my teams have gone to the World Series four times, and each time the team that won the first game won the series. I do think it was more important back in those days because of the umpiring. I really do. That the home field advantage was that much more important in part because of the umpiring. Today, that difference doesn't exist. But I still think the first game of the series is really critically important.
Huge. I think demonstrated by the fact that only the 0-4 Red Sox and the ALCS have ever come back from a 3-0 deficit in the playoffs. How many teams during the course of the year win four straight games, but in the postseason it doesn't happen because it feels like momentum, it's like a tidal wave that starts.
Yeah. Well, I look at the 2015 series with the Mets, and we lost that first game. And we lost it in the first inning with an inside the park home run that could have been caught. And then we lost it in the ninth inning again with a lead and gave up a home run to tie it on a quick pitch. So anyway, the first game of the series is critical, and particularly if you can win the first game on the road, it's big. But anyway, the way it goes.
1989, the year you guys won the World Series with Oakland. You win the first couple games, and then, of course, the earthquake occurs before Game 3. Where were you when that occurred, and what were the first things that you were doing?
There were I was in a suite down the left field line, way down the left field line, almost in the at the foul pole, and it's the earthquake started and there was a lot of shaking. And initially my thought was that the fans in the upper deck, and the suites were kind of attached to the upper deck, that the fans in the upper deck were stomping their feet. And it was just a crowd reaction, kind of an anticipation for the game to start shortly. And then it kept going, and had men realized, this is an earthquake. And I had lived in the Bay Area for, that was 89. So I've been in the Bay Area for almost 15 years, and I'd gone through other earthquakes. The interesting thing about earthquakes is you can go through three or four of them, and they're all different because you're always in a different place. You might be in a tall building, you might be in a baseball stadium, you might be in a car, and you experience these things differently. But anyway, realized it was an earthquake at some point. And so my wife and I, my son, who was at the game, got in the door frame. That was always the thing you were supposed to do, get in the door frame or something if you couldn't do anything else. So that's where we rode it out. For the next, 30 seconds or so, whatever it was. But what was it, my first reaction was that this was going to delay the game, because the lights went out. But it wasn't until a few minutes later that there was any, apparent, damage, because there was no apparent damage at the ballpark except for the lights going out. But then we started getting images, you know, over the TV of what had happened on the Bay Bridge and the freeway in Oakland and some places in the immediate coverage was, you know, damage to the freeways. So at that point, you know, everything else was superseded by the fact that, wow, this was serious. This was an earthquake that did damage. And, you know, we're not sure what's going to happen. Now, the story within a story is interesting from a baseball standpoint, because that was game three. And our starting pitcher for that night was Bob Welch. Pitched the first game. Mike Moore pitched the second game. Bob Welch was going to start the third game. A couple of days, though, before his start, Bob Welch was shagging in the outfield and pulled a hamstring.
Mm.
And we weren't sure whether he was going to be able to start. So we were going to wait and see how he warmed up. And we had Kurt Young, who was going to substitute for him if he couldn't pitch. This is sort of a commentary on the relationship among teams and kind of how the game is viewed these days. But so we knew Welch was probably doubtful. So when we turned in our lineup to the umpires, we told the umpires that Welch might not be able to pitch. And if he didn't pitch, we were going to substitute a left-hander. And so tell the Giants, you know, if we decide that Young is going to pitch, make sure the Giants have a chance to change their lineup, you know, so that they okay, now we got a lefty going as opposed to a righty. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that the Giants had a fair opportunity with more than just a minute or two to figure out their lineup if Welch wasn't pitching. But Welch wasn't going to pitch.
Wow.
You know, we thought, well, gee, if the game is postponed today, maybe he can pitch tomorrow. But I think as it turned out, he just wasn't able to pitch. And so you may not recall this, but we only used two starters in that whole series.
Yep.
Stewart and Moore pitched all four games. And Bob Welch had a great year for us that year, but he wasn't going to be able to pitch. Nobody really knew about that. But you know, these days, I'm not sure if you decide to switch pitchers at the last minute that anybody's going to give you a chance to change your lineup. But, you know, it's a little different ballgame than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's a lot more cutthroat, which actually leads me into my last topic for you perfectly. Your path into baseball was unusual for its time at that time. You know, you went from Dartmouth. You served in the Marines, Harvard Law, and you actually joined the Athletics as general counsel first. And then 2 years later, you became the general manager. That's not unusual in this era, as you know better than I do. Clearly, as Chris Antonetti of the Indians said to me, he said, my resume that I had when I had coming out of college would have been laughed at today because you have all these Ivy Leaguers who want to get into baseball following the publication of the book Moneyball. I was curious about the first time you read Moneyball, what your first reaction was, because, of course, you are at the root of that.
Well, honestly, my first reaction was that that a lot of what was discussed in Moneyball, I would have considered proprietary in a sense. You know, we started using statistical analysis, and this goes back to the early 80s and my particular situation, because I didn't really have, you know, I didn't have a background in scouting or player development or what have you. So in terms of evaluating players, I had to come up with something. And it just so happened that, you know, Bill James was starting to write at that time. And a lot of his theories rang true to me, some of which was, you know, provable mathematically. So anyway, we moved in that direction in part out of necessity. Now it's not as if what we were doing was, you know, proprietary in the sense you could patent it or what have you. But I think what Moneyball did was put it all together for people to understand. And I think what it led to was really a top-down revolution in the game. Because I think a lot of owners read that book and said, you know what? This is exactly what I do in my other business. You know, remember John Henry, who was into art, you know, made all his money in arbitrage investments and stuff like that, right up his alley. I mean, the light must have gone on immediately. And I think that happened for a lot of owners. And this ended up being sort of a top-down revolution. And you can see that. You can see the residue of that today. I mean, it's still a top-down strategy. And, you know, what I try to emphasize with scouts and player development people as much as I can is that, you know, this is not going away. And on the other hand, you're in the best position to take advantage of it, because if you can become, you know, facile with the statistics and the analysis and understand it all together with your baseball background, you can be extraordinarily valuable. But I think my first reaction was, wow, okay. They're laying it all out there. And I was, you know, a little bit surprised by that. But it's, you know, again, it's not like it was something you could patent. There were other clubs that were kind of approaching it similarly in those days, maybe not to the same extent as the A's in that Moneyball era, but it did kind of tie it all together and then made it available to people who, owners as much as anybody else, who, you know, could dictate where things went from there.
Yeah, absolutely inspired a generation of front office executives, for sure. Sandy, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. You had some amazing stories. That Michael Jordan story, I'm shaking my head here.
Well, yeah, that was, you know, of course, the only time I think I told that story publicly before was in front of a group of fans who asked me why I signed Tim Tebow. And I have to say that there was a part of the Michael Jordan history in that Tim Tebow signing. But, you know, I also thought that Tim had a, you know, that there would be other benefits to the organization from Tim Tebow being involved. And I don't think I've been disappointed. He's been a terrific ambassador for the Mets and for baseball. And, you know, notwithstanding, you know, a bunch of criticism at the time and to some extent that still exists, but, Tim, I thought, had a more legitimate potential over time because he was committed to the sport as opposed to maybe it simply being a distraction from something else. But anyway, you know, one of the great things about baseball we all have to keep in mind is it's entertainment. It's okay, it's a game, but let's not get too carried away. You know, let's not be super serious here and take ourselves too seriously. This is, you know, it's entertainment, and they're from time to time needs to be a recognition of that element as well. So,
and Sandy, I think that's especially going to be true as we come out of these current circumstances, and, you know, everyone working to that end to make it as entertaining as possible. I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay, Buster, enjoyed it. Thanks.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. At The Starting Block writes in, how do you think this year will change the way Hall of Fame voting considers the cumulative numbers for this generation of players, i.e. will a 3,000-hit guy certainly be now a 2,800-hit guy due to a lost season? I'm sure they'll adjust in their voting and their criteria, I'd have to imagine.
No question about it. Look, when we talk about Ted Williams in his Hall of Fame case, you know, it's always brought up that he lost basically five seasons right in the prime of his career because he served in the military. Joe DiMaggio was in the same boat. A lot of players were in the same boat. And I do think that voters will make their adjustments based on circumstances, because we all know what 2020 is going to be remembered for.
Absolutely. Last one for today. Cinegrades at Cinegrades writes in, I am currently reading your book, The Last Night of the Yankee Dynasty, probably available on Amazon or if Buster has a website, who knows? And Cinegrades can't put it down. He asks, who on those Yankee teams was your favorite player to cover and why?
Man, I had a blast covering that team because those guys love baseball and they love talking about baseball. It was a different experience than the 2 years I covered the Orioles where it could be really difficult. Mariano Rivera, I have always been fascinated with because he was such an unusual personality. I tell friends all the time that, you know, he's the same person now that he was the first time I met him when he wasn't necessarily a superstar. And another guy on those teams was Homer Bush. Kind of a guy like the 25th guy in the team in the 98 team. But Homer was great to talk with because he just had an incredible memory and he spoke anecdotally. And so after a lot of big events happened that year and you'd have crowded reporters going around Jeter, who would, you know, he made a practice. Derek made a practice of saying nothing. I would run over to Homer's locker and ask him what he saw because he always had the most incredible observations and things that he saw. And it was really cool. So he was one of the guys that I enjoyed interviewing.
We love a guy who speaks anecdotally here on the podcast.
As we've been demonstrating in these interviews in recent weeks, because we've been going for those stories and anecdotes.
Absolutely. Subscribe, rate, and review to the podcast wherever you get those podcasts. Check out First Draft of the College Football Podcast. Thanks, everyone.
And by the way, before we go, when we were done our interview with Sandy, he couldn't come up immediately with the name of Michael Jordan's agent. That was David Falk. And he was like, yeah, that's it. That's it. So David Falk was the person that he talked to about perhaps offering a major league job to Michael Jordan. That was a really cool story. That's it for today. My thanks to Taylor and to Sandy Alderson. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.